Right, so I'm going to discuss some preliminary results obtained with Sean McCotrew and Jason Kumar. And as John said, this is the first part of a one-hour talk on this work. So when I get my red card, there will be a substitution, and Shamit will continue. So as you know, one of our biggest challenges is to understand why the cosmological constant is so small, perhaps even zero, without having unbroken supersymmetry. And one natural place to look for answers is to the class of non-supersymmetric string vacua. But so far, these have typically generated a cosmological constant perturbatively in the accompanying dilaton tadpole, which causes the theory to run off to zero coupling. We will present what we think is a counterexample of this, that is, a non-supersymmetric string vacuum in which the supersymmetry is broken right at the string scale, which appears to have lambda equals zero order by order in G string. We'll be quite concrete about the one and two loop contributions, and though we're still working on the precise formulation of the higher loop amplitudes, I think you'll see why we're optimistic that they will also involve symmetries which cause cancellations in the higher loop amplitudes as well. But at the very end of the second talk, we'll discuss how we think this example fits into a broader framework relating fixed lines of the renormalization group in quantum field theory to string backgrounds with flat dilaton potentials. And this would hopefully allow us to generate more examples. So let's get down to this particular example. I want to consider this asymmetric orbifold. I've indicated the generators of the orbifold group here by F and G, and their action is indicated on the left moving RNS degrees of freedom and the right moving RNS degrees of freedom. These S actions are left-right symmetric shifts by half lattice vectors, and they occur in both the generating elements. And in addition, we have a minus 1 to the F right action going along with F and a minus 1 to the F left action going along with G. What this does is act for the minus sign on any fermionic spacetime fermionic degrees of freedom coming from the right movers, and similarly, minus 1 to the F left does the same thing for spacetime fermionic degrees of freedom coming from left movers. These shifts will have important implications for us. They first of all ensure that there aren't any massless twisted states, so in particular we don't regain supersymmetries in twisted sectors, and we don't regain unwanted scalars in twisted sectors. They also encode or lead to the fact that these generators don't commute. This is a non-abelian orbifold. This is just because shifts and reflections don't commute, as you can easily see. So F and G don't commute up to chiral shifts, each of which is actually order 2 on the original string scale torus that we started out with, which you can see by looking at the quantization of the left and right moving zero modes of the string on this torus. Okay, so this orbifold satisfies level matching and all the conditions, at least I know of, for higher loop modular invariants, namely those due to Fried and Vatha. So as far as we know, it's a consistent string background. And as I mentioned earlier, these minus 1 to the F actions kill fermionic degrees of freedom, and in particular, they kill the Gravitino vertex operators from both the left and right moving degrees of freedom. So the massless spectrum is as follows. It's quite symmetric, although not supersymmetric. There is no Gravitino. It has equal numbers of bosons and fermions and equal numbers of states coming from each sector of the RNS superstring. A property that the spectrum has that will be important for us is that it has the same number. If we think about the theory first modded out by G, ignoring the F part of the orbifold, it has the same number of F invariant as F anti-invariant states in just the theory projected by G. You'll see why I care about that in a bit. Finally, in addition to the perturbative string spectrum, this theory has a spectrum of non-perturbative states, such as D-brains, and the way to think about those is to realize that when you do one of these asymmetric orbifolds, what you're essentially doing is modding out by T-duality. We know how T-duality acts on D-brains, so we get some invariant combinations of brains. For example, if we start off with a D0 brain on this torus, it's mapped by F to a D4 brain on the first four cycles, and so on. This will allow us to find a solution in this background Reiser-Nordson black holes, whose near-horizon geometry is ADS2 times S2, and that will relate to our later attempts to generalize these examples. But I'm going to stick with the direct analysis of this background. And I mentioned that F and G don't commute. And in fact, if you use the algebra satisfied by our group elements, you can show, in fact, that no pair of commuting group elements breaks all the supersymmetry. You have to consider every possible element of this group. And none of the pairs of elements which commute project out all the gravitinos. Each of them, in fact, leaves at least n equals 2 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. In thinking then about the path integral prescription for computing one loop amplitudes in the orbifold theory, this immediately implies that the one loop vacuum energy, as well as untwisted tadpoles and master normalizations, vanish rather trivially. That's because if you consider the one loop amplitude, which is a path integral on a torus, you only sum over commuting group elements, because otherwise you would be trying to twist around a cycle which is zero in homology on the torus. And since no pair of commuting elements breaks all of the supersymmetry, each contribution here is effectively supersymmetric, and there's a zero mode, and the amplitude vanishes for that reason. Now, at higher loops, the Bose-Fermi degeneracy, which is what's implied by this point-by-point cancellation at one loop, is, of course, not in itself sufficient to cancel the cosmological constant because our interactions are not supersymmetric. In particular, at two loops, for example, we would run into twist structures like this. My notation here is that if I draw a line like this labeled by F, that's a cut on the Riemann surface through which world sheet fields transform according to their F eigenvalue, and similarly for G. So in this diagram, we have around this B cycle of the Riemann surface, there is a twist by F, and similarly here for G. My point is that this is completely consistent with the homology relations of the Riemann surface and contains the information about the full supersymmetry breaking, because in particular it involves twists by both F and G. So you could ask, is there really any reason to believe this should work? And there is a heuristic reason to think that it might, and that is the symmetry in the spectrum that I mentioned earlier. There is a symmetry in the spectrum of the orbifold just by that generator G, between states which are invariant under F and states which are anti-invariant under F. And if you then think about an amplitude like this, which involves a G twisted diagram out of which comes a propagator with an F projection, or an insertion of the operator F, you'll see that you might expect, because of this symmetry, that when you trace over these states, you'll have the same number of contributions with a plus one from the F insertion as you have contributions with a minus one from the anti-invariant states of the F projection, and there might be hope that this diagram will also cancel. That's in fact what we're going to see by explicitly writing down the spin structure dependence piece of that amplitude. In order to see that, I want to first go back to a simpler case, one of the one-loop contributions, which, of course, we know has to vanish by supersymmetry, and just see in full detail how that works just at the level of this one-loop supersymmetric amplitude, and then we'll go back to the two-loop contribution that we're really interested in. So in order to compute this amplitude, what you do is trace over states with this insertion of this F projection operator, or I don't really mean the projection operator, I just mean the operator F itself. And that's encoded in theta functions. Remember that if we have a fermion twisted by angles A and B here, its determinant is given by a theta function with characteristics A and B, and a eta function in the denominator. And this is just the same thing as what you get by tracing over the states. So in order to compute the full amplitude, what we need to do is sum over spin structures. I'm just going to first sum over the spin structures for the left-moving fermions that I'll call psi 1 through 8. At the level of the one-loop diagram, we can simply consider the transverse fermions. Our contribution then looks like this. There's a theta function for each complex fermion. We have 4 complex transverse fermions, and they break up into 2 sets, 2 complex fermions which are acted on by F and 2 complex fermions which are not. And because of the F projection in the B cycle here, that changes the theta function characteristic by a shift of 1/2 relatively between these two sets of fermions. So we get a contribution of this form. And there are some phases here which encode the GSO projection. Let's consider first contributions to this sum which have A equals 1/2. And what that means in terms of the original fermions is that the fermions are periodic around this A cycle. So we're in the Ramon sector, if you like, propagating in this direction. Now, if the fermions are also periodic around the B cycle, then there's a zero mode which causes this contribution to vanish, and that's encoded in the theta function by the fact that theta of 1/2, 1/2 at zero is zero. So all terms like that in this sum vanish for that reason, before really any summing is required. So then we're left with the sum of this form, where now all we need to consider is the A characteristic being zero. And A being zero means that the fermions are anti-periodic around this A cycle, which means we have no short sector states propagating. And the contribution here is just a sum of two terms of the same functional form, because when we sum over B, all we do is shift the 1/2 from this side to that side, and the two contributions are completely symmetric because, again, we have half the fermions acted on by F and half not. So the only question is, what are these phases in the two terms? So if we normalize the first term to 1, the second term is actually a minus 1, and that's because in the Nevill-Schwartz sector, when we do the GSO projection, we project onto states satisfying minus 1 to the F equals minus S, minus 1 to the F equals minus 1. That's so that we project onto an odd number of fermions and project out the tachyon in the usual way. So this is just that sign, and that's why we get a zero contribution here. Now, this same mechanism is essentially going to carry over to the two-loop diagram that we're really interested in, and we think higher. But to analyze this case carefully, we really need to go back to the 80s, when these people, and I'm sure many others that I've unfortunately forgotten, were busy working out the many subtle features of superstring perturbation theory, in particular the questions of how you properly integrate over moduli and supermoduli. So for the benefit of those of us who are not around then or might have forgotten, I'm going to review that story a little bit. When we do string perturbation theory, we consider the Polyakov path integral, in which we integrate over all the world sheet fields, including the world sheet graviton and gravitino. And then much of that gets divided out when we divide out by the gauge transformations, diffeomorphisms, and local supersymmetry transformations. But there's a finite set of deformations which can't be absorbed into those types of gauge transformations, and these are the moduli and supermoduli. There are 3 complex moduli and 2g-2 complex supermoduli when you work out the topology. Now, it's realized that things simplify greatly if you take the world sheet gravitino to have delta function support. So you expand in the supermoduli, the 2g-2 complex supermoduli, in terms of a delta function Beltrami differential. And we can do this as long as this choice of gauge slice for the gravitino satisfies various important conditions, like that the integration be transverse to the gauge slice that we picked, and that the choice of points at which we localize the gravitino be a modular invariant, that it respects the modular invariance that we know has to be there in the amplitude. So after you take that into account, after you check that and pick your points appropriately, you then can change variables from integrating over the original metric and gravitino to integration over the moduli and supermoduli, and that introduces a Jacobian, a determinant factor. And the end result, once you do that and then integrate over the Grassmannian supermoduli, you get an expression for the partition function that looks like this. We need to sum over the spin structures, and in our case, the orbifold twist structures. Integrate over the moduli, do the usual path integral, and there are some insertions that came into the path integral because of the integration over the supermoduli, which again came from the integration over the gravitino, and they just follow from the fact that the gravitino, of course, couples to the world sheet supercurrent. In addition to that, there's a ghost piece, which is part of the Jacobian. So the upshot of what I've discussed so far is that basically at higher genus, instead of just evaluating determinants, you need to evaluate correlation functions of these assertions coming from the integration over supermoduli. Now you might wonder, again, if you weren't part of the story, what these points have to do with any physical quantities, and they more or less are not physical, the choice of these points, but there is an important subtlety, and that is that changing the position of those points changes the amplitude by a total derivative on the moduli space. So we have to worry about potential boundary contributions, but other than that, we are going to pick our points in the most auspicious way so that we can see what the bulk amplitude is really doing. So in order to write down our two-loop diagram, we can do that following work of Verlinde and Verlinde, and I imagine other people in the late 80s. And we can, and again, this is going to come out in terms of theta functions. On higher genus surfaces, one has theta functions, which have a sum expansion like this, in terms of these objects. So this is again basically generalizing the. Well, this is going to come into the expressions for the partition functions at higher genus, just like it did for genus 1. So for those who aren't familiar with this kind of thing, what appears here is the period matrix for the Riemann surface, which generalizes the complex structure tau of the torus, and is given in terms of the canonical 1 forms on the Riemann surface in this way. Okay, so we're almost ready to see how this works. The contributions from these correlation functions, I'm just here going to do the contributions coming from the matter part of the world sheet supercurrent. There are ghost contributions, which lead to other terms, which also similarly cancel, but I won't go through those details here. So let's just think about this contribution. It involves terms of this form. If we, for example, consider the terms in this correlation function, which involve contractions of the first four RNS fermions with each other, then we have some z dependence of their amplitude, which is given by this theta function, and the ghost piece involves some z dependence and also some dependence on a background spin structure that you need to include in the computation of ghost correlators, which is basically related to the fact that there is a ghost number anomaly on the Riemann surface, on Riemann surfaces of non-zero curvature. But anyway, we're getting an expression rather similar to the one we had at one loop. Similarly, if we contract the other six RNS fermions, we get a contribution like this. And what I'm going to do now is pick the point at which we inserted the gravitino to be at z1 equals z2 equals the point given by this divisor for the reference spin structure. And then these expressions are going to simplify very nicely. So what happens there is that the denominator cancels one of the numerator theta functions, and we're left with an expression like this. Again, because of this F twist around this B cycle, there are half the fermions have one characteristic along that cycle, and half of them have a characteristic shifted by one half along that cycle. And let's start again by considering the terms in which alpha 1, which is the twist along the A cycle of this torus, are one half, which is to say it's periodic around this A cycle. So one more fact we need to know about these theta functions is that it's even or odd in Z if four A dot B, where A and B are, again, these characteristics, is even or odd. And if it's odd, then, of course, it vanishes at 0, where we're actually evaluating it. This is completely equivalent to statements about fermion zero modes. So if you look at this contribution, you can see that the difference between 4 A dot B for this guy and for this guy is just given by this, which is minus 1, and which, of course, is an odd number. So if alpha 1 is a half, then one or the other of these theta functions has a zero mode because its characteristic is odd. And we get a zero for those terms because of that zero mode. So then again, as in the one loop diagram that we went over, we're left with the contributions which are antiperiodic around this A cycle, which are denoted by alpha 1 equals 0 theta characteristics. So again, this has to do with Nevill-Schwartz states propagating in this loop. And again, summing over beta 1 then gives two terms of equivalent functional form. The shift just appears in this factor or in that factor in the two terms, but they're isomorphic. And we only then need to worry again about this phase. And again, it's still the case at higher genus that when you project, when you do the GSO projection in the NS sector, you project onto minus 1 to the F equals minus 1. And we get a relative minus sign between these two contributions. So the whole thing vanishes before we even had to worry about summing over the spin structures here. So we have found that despite the lack of supersymmetry in this diagram, the contribution does vanish. In the next talk, we'll find out why that diagram was really canonical and is up to modular transformations the only one we needed to consider. But given that, I will stop here for questions.
Greg asks, why can you choose the points Z1 equals Z2 equal delta?
Okay, well, so as you know very well, since you studied this very carefully with Attic and Sen, you in general can't pick your points as you wish because you have to satisfy these conditions. The first condition, if in a hyperelliptic description of the surface, the points we're picking are basically branch points, and you showed in your paper with Attic and Sen that choice does satisfy this transversality constraint. You also showed that it doesn't satisfy modular invariance for the flat space theory. In our situation, we have a twist structure which has a much reduced modular group if you consider the modular transformations which preserve that twist structure. So when we do our computation with these F and G twists, you have to ask what is the modular domain that you actually integrate over. It's not the fundamental domain of the full modular group. Sean is going to explain in great detail what the domain is, what its boundaries are, and see that the contributions vanish and that the choice of points here was consistent with modular invariance because the modular group is so much reduced in this twist structure.
Vipul Parawal asked whether she's using that the two-loop curves have a hyperelliptic representation.
In terms of these issues of picking the points in a completely consistent way, that's really our main obstruction to being completely precise at higher genus, in fact. However, one thing that can be said is, again, in reference to this question of modular invariance, is, and again, this is something that was said in Greg's earlier papers, is if you get a zero integrand, then it's not clear why you have an issue of modular invariance anyway. I mean, the integrand is clearly modular invariant if it's actually zero. So I'm not completely sure that's an issue. If it is an issue, then yes, to be completely precise, we are using facts about genus 2 that we don't have as much control over at higher genus.
Assuming this works in genus 2,
yes.
What is the mechanism? wouldn't it appear that at least the mechanism you described wouldn't work in higher genus? If you simply glue together a couple of surfaces looking like that type, then you'll eventually get a situation where spin structure can be even for all terminals.
Well, again, this will be discussed in the next talk, but you can actually do a modular transformation at higher genus to move these twists to two cycles of, like this, and then the rest of the surface. And then the rest of the surface is just, well, let's see. It's going to be discussed in the next talk, but you can do a modular transformation to make this a canonical choice, actually. And the reason that we think it should work at higher genus is, again, just that you have these cancellations between F invariant states and F anti-invariant states in a diagram with F and G, and then the rest of the diagram untwisted.
Let me use my prerogative to ask whether the massless spectrum contains a dilaton.
The massless spectrum, does it contain? Yeah, it contains the ordinary four-dimensional gravity, but not gravitino. Let's put.
And a scalar dilaton.
And a scalar dilaton, yeah. Well,
Harvey asked if this is a unique example or a member of a large class.
We don't know for sure that it's a member of a large class. The properties that I listed at the beginning, the fact that no single group element, no commuting pair of group elements breaks all the supersymmetry, is presumably more general than just this example. We also think it fits into extrapolations of the ADS-CFT correspondence to flat space, which we think would predict even more general examples that wouldn't have to vanish point by point. But again, that'll be discussed a little bit more in the next talk.
Not seeing any more hands, let's give Eva a round of applause. And now,